In accepting the Republican Party's nomination for Senate of Illinois in 1858, Abraham Lincoln asserted that a house divided against itself cannot stand, that the nation could not remain permanently half slave states and permanently half free states. We remember that speech. We don't tend to remember the counterargument of his opponent, Stephen Douglas, in that Senate race, which consisted of two words: why not? We aren't used to old Abe being challenged anymore. He's venerated, and his words now fill books, as well they should. It is fitting for the poet President Lincoln. But Lincoln was also a politician in a time period of combative partisan politics, when a new party, the Republican Party, was founded, composed of Northern Democrats and Northern Whigs who were against slavery. Stephen Douglas was a respected Northern Democrat whose views on slavery were not as extreme, certainly, as other Democrats in his party or the Buchanan administration. Some Illinois Republicans did not even want to challenge him in his reelection, but Lincoln took him on. The Lincoln-Douglas debates should be read. They are a mixture of political sideshows, race-baiting, defensive statements, attempts to throw each opponent under the bus, as we might say today, attempts to strawman, to make an opponent's argument seem worse than it is. And there are also moments of supreme intellectual rigor and logical reasoned arguments. To Lincoln's campaign slogan, "A house divided against itself cannot stand," Douglas answered, "Why not?" The house, the nation, America, had been divided at that point for 70 years, with one section half slave and one section free. Why couldn't it continue? It shines a light on where Lincoln was in the 1858 political spectrum. Was he, for instance, really the moderate that he's presented as now? When he lost the Senate race, cheated out of it by apportioning it, the Republicans and Lincoln won the Senate race by popular vote. But Douglas and the Democratic Party had more seats in the Assembly. Douglas's friends, the Democrats, voted him to the Senate seat. When a supporter wrote to console Lincoln, Lincoln wrote back, "Well, Douglas managed through his ingenuity to get the support of free staters and slave staters. We'll see if his ingenuity will be enough to preserve the harmony in the future." Lincoln, house divided against itself cannot stand, was a bit fatalistic about the issue of slavery in America, especially as that issue went westward. The Civil War should not be taken lightly. There's a lot of coverage of the Civil War in school and in media sources. Civil War books sell. I do think, though, that for all the attention on the Civil War, for all the attention on the war parts, the military battles, how regiments moved and how, you know, Lee's army encircled Hooker's army, etc., that part of the Civil War is emphasized, and the politics, while discussed in most presentations of the Civil War, could be considered further. To simplify it, I think the causes of the Civil War could come down to three E's and three C's: the Constitution, culture, and confidence; expansion, extremes, and economics. Let's start with the Constitution. You know, we really could blame the Civil War on the Constitution. Well, there's something to say for that. A compromise, one that Rufus King said weighed greatly on his mind, and Roger Sherman said came only with great difficulty, was arrived at the Constitutional Convention, where, for representation purposes, each slave would count as 3/5 of a person. Without that clause, it was pretty clear that South Carolina and Georgia, at least among the southern states, would walk. Well, wait a second. Luther Martin of Maryland, who had a lot of criticisms at the Constitutional Convention and afterward, but participated in all the debates, he owned a few slaves himself too. But he said, look, if you do this, if you put this 3/5 rule in, the southern states can just keep importing slaves in until, even with only counting 3/5 of them, they have all the votes and can control the country. So this was debated. Perhaps they'd put a federal tax on the importation of slaves. But it was decided instead to restrict Congress from passing any law banning the importation of the slave trade until 1800. Why did the South go along with this? Well, not everyone did, but the more moderate members did. Virginia had already banned the importation of slaves, so you could own slaves. If slaves had children, they would still be considered a slave, but you could not import slaves from Africa. There was certainly activity that went on under the table, though, throughout the time of slavery in America. This would address Luther Martin's point. It wasn't necessarily primarily to stop slavery, since Martin was a slave owner, but it was to stop a state from artificially adding representation simply by importing more and more slaves. Issue of slavery, it can best be said, was punted by the Constitution. Everyone thought it was horrific if they were from the North and it was defended by Southern representatives, but no one seriously talked about banning slavery. The founding document of the nation not addressing one of the major issues of the nation. Certainly then, our first letter C, the Constitution, is one, and its vagueness on this issue is one of the reasons that it eventually required a war. Our first E, expansion. I think the first thing you need to understand about the Civil War is why did fighting break out, right? Is to understand that fighting had already broken out in America. Free staters and slave staters were already fighting in Kansas. And many of the people there would join the Union or Confederate armies. I think expansion, by that I mean the expansion of slavery into new territories, or the banning of slavery into new territories that might later become states, is the most serious driver for civil war, why it had to lead to fighting rather than a political resolution. And Kansas was a battleground, politically and militarily. The Compromise of 1850, put through by Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, prohibited slavery in northern territories, but as a bargain required the return of fugitive slaves. 4 years later, this was changed. The Kansas-Nebraska Act, passed under the Franklin Pierce administration, allowed popular sovereignty. This was the idea of Stephen Douglas. The new territories could themselves vote whether to be slave or free. The federal government would not have a role in that decision. It would be the people who settled the territories. This certainly upset not only abolitionists in the North, but also moderate, fairly moderate politicians such as Abraham Lincoln, because it would surely lead to an expansion of slavery outside where it existed now. Sure, there would be some territories, particularly the northern territories, which just tended to get more settlers from the North, that would vote to remain free. But it was clear with the Kansas-Nebraska Act that new states could become slave states, and slavery would be expanded. So it had that effect. It was vague in this respect. Who decides? You have a territory. Is it just going to be those who decided to settle there? What's to stop new people from moving in just to cast a vote for this free or slave state referendum? In Kansas, a group of Missourians would routinely cross the border to vote and to cause trouble. Border ruffians, they were called. Violence broke out between slave staters and free staters. The majority of settlers in Kansas most likely would vote for a free state in a fair election. The settlement around Lawrence was the most populated, primarily settlers from the North, from Pennsylvania, from Massachusetts. These were free staters. But when a vote was held to have a territorial convention, hopefully have a state constitution, it is most likely the case that there was widespread fraud. And as it turned out, the slave states got more representatives to the convention than the free state settlers. The free state settlers boycotted the convention. And so in the town of Lecompton, Kansas, a convention was held. The only disagreement between the two sides was whether to pass a constitution and send it to Congress, or whether to pass a constitution and allow a referendum of all the settlers, which may go down, since there was a significant amount of free staters in the territory. Despite the fact that this was just a disagreement between two sides who were both supporting slavery in Kansas, it did get a little heated. And to solve this minor difference, what it says is that the Constitution will go to a vote of all Kansans. But even if it's voted down, Kansans who have slaves would be allowed to keep them. They would not have to set them free if they were remained on Kansas soil. Now, this presented a problem for the Kansas-Nebraska Act, for the Buchanan administration, and for Stephen Douglas. Because the Kansas-Nebraska Act said that territories get a vote on whether they want to be free or slave. This was a conditional vote. Whether or not the state of Kansas voted to be free or slave, even if they voted to be free, those who had slaves could keep them. That's not a free state. So it was still considered an expansion of slavery for the free staters. President Buchanan has a decision to make. He can endorse the Constitution, have a statehood bill sent through Congress, and sign it. Or he can send it back to the territorial legislation, say this isn't good enough, involve everybody, full and free, fair vote, and then we'll do it. Buchanan was concerned of the politics within his own party, to be sure. The Democratic Party had a strong base of Southern supporters. He's also ostensibly concerned with violence in Kansas. If some type of constitution didn't get approved, there would just be constant battles over, and each constitutional convention would be declared illegitimate. Something had to be done. This was action versus lack of action. He approves the Constitution, endorses it, goes through Congress, and he signs it. This killed the Northern Democratic Party. It was a huge issue in the North. It was tantamount to approving the expansion of slavery out West. Even the Richmond Inquirer said it was ill-advised to approve the Lecompton Constitution. Yet Buchanan did it. The expansion of slavery into Kansas and into the Western territories, I believe, is the biggest issue behind the Civil War because it was a question that both sides disagreed on vehemently. For abolitionists and even for moderate Republicans, they could not permit the expansion of slavery beyond the states where it existed now. Moderate Republicans like Lincoln, slavery's evil, it's horrific, but it exists, it's an institution in these states. There's not much we can do about that, but what we must do is keep it from spreading. For the Southerners, if they were not allowed to expand slavery into Western states, their economy could not grow, and the territories would be taken over and in effect controlled by the North. So the territories were the jewel that the war was fought over. This plays into one of the C's in this debate, and that is culture. Culture is a cause of the Civil War. The South and the North were very different places. Yes, you might say, we know the South and the North are very different places today. That's to be certain. But there is more interaction now than there was. There were a series of rivers that separated the area of the Confederacy from the area known as the Union. Rivers that would prove deadly for McClellan and Grant and other Union generals in campaign after campaign. Rivers that would help protect the Confederacy. Prior to the war, the river system and the lack of north-to-south railroads and roads led to cultural differences. While the North was bustling with railroads, the South had just a few. The railroads they had were designed to transport cotton and other crops, and so were mostly connecting major cities to hubs of commerce. When Democrats, in 1860, attempted a unity convention that they would hold in the South, Charleston, South Carolina, the New Yorkers had to change trains 10 times to get to Charleston, South Carolina. The North was more industrialized than the South. We know this, more urban. We know this. The major cities in the South, particularly New Orleans, were perhaps better connected with world capitals, Paris, London, than they were connected to the Northern Yankees. And then in this discussion of culture, there is, of course, the peculiar institution, as it was known in the South, slavery. Kevin Phillips, in his book, The Cousin Wars, notes how the states came into secession almost perfectly aligned in the order of the percentage of their population that were slaves. This is interesting because you have certain revisionist movements now. You have the governor of Virginia, Confederate History Day, talking about, you know, the causes of the Civil War, and at least initially not even mentioning slavery. But it's pretty clear. South Carolina came first, 48.7% of its population slaves, December 1860. Mississippi with 48%, 1861. Florida with 36% was next. Alabama with 35% of population slaves next. Georgia with 38. That's the anomaly. It shot up a little bit. Louisiana with 32, and Texas with 28% population slaves. The counties, the very few anti-Confederate counties within the Confederacy's borders, such as Jones County, Mississippi, were also low slaveholding counties. It's hard to make an argument, as it is sometimes made in revisionist history, that the Civil War was not about slavery, that it was about tariffs or states' rights. The tariffs were annoying, to be sure. You definitely had politicians like Jefferson Davis saying that, you know, the North is forcing us to buy its high-priced goods with these tariffs. But it couldn't have caused the gunfire. Slavery was the one issue that brought the guns out in Kansas, in Harper's Ferry, in South Carolina, before the war officially started. But how could slavery as a cultural element of the South that was under assault be one of the reasons why people resorted to fighting? Only a few families, less than 5% of the South, owned any significant amount of slaves. 95% of the population had either few slaves or none. Even though only a small percentage of people had slaves, poor Southerners wanted to be those people. You did not get rich in the South unless you owned land and slaves. Expansion of slavery was an appeal not to the rich. It was an appeal to the middle class and the lower class white Southerners, many who didn't have slaves but wanted to live the plantation life. As a Georgian wrote, "Remove the restrictions on slavery, and where is there a poor man in the South who cannot become a slaveholder?" This plays into one of the E's, economics, closely related. Wealth in northern capitals was tied up in machinery. In the South, it was land and human bondage. An assault on the peculiar institution was an economic assault. "We will become the slave of the North," Jefferson Davis said. Western expansion of slavery was needed for new fortunes to be made. Not allowing that was denying new fortunes. The Panic of 1857 accelerated everything because it ruined fortunes in the South. It depressed cotton prices, and it made land and expansion all the more important. The Panic of 1857 was certainly one of the sparks of the war. Our fifth reason is extremes, and extremes in politics. If you go back to 1859, that marks the point that the extremists in both parties, Democrat and Republican, assumed leadership and gained momentum. The Republicans started in 1854 to protest that Kansas-Nebraska Act. They had started moderately and Whiggishly to keep old Whigs and Northern Democrats in the coalition. But they were flogged soon by abolitionists and radical Republicans to go further than that. William Lloyd Garrison, the most famous abolitionist, said that the Constitution was a pact made in hell because it required the enforcement of the fugitive slave laws, and it said a slave was 3/5 of a person. Wendell Phillips saw no problem goading the new star of the Republican Party. He said Lincoln was a huckster and a slave hound because Lincoln had supported the fugitive slave law, that Northerners had to return slaves who had run away. Of course, the most famous abolitionist extremist was John Brown. After his battles in Kansas, Brown wanted to bring the battle home to the South. He rented a farm in Maryland under the name Smith, and he quickly acquired guns and ammunition. He put out word to slaves in the local area to join an army. Only 6 joined. He tried to get Frederick Douglass, a free black and abolitionist, to join him and to encourage others to. Douglass thought that John Brown was a little crazy and that his plan, which was to seize Harper's Ferry, the federal armory, and start a slave revolt, was stupid. The target was in a valley, and it could be easily surrounded. John Brown went ahead with his plan, took over the armory, and put out word to slaves that it was time to revolt. Revolt didn't happen, and a force commanded by Robert E. Lee captured him. Extreme politics around this incident prevailed. On the surface, there was not much here. Brown was insane, or so thought many Northern abolitionists who talked to him. Republican politicians wanted very little to do with him. And what he did do, in a way, proved that both Northern dreams and Southern fears of a slave uprising was unfounded. Here was a guy that took over a federal armory and told slaves to join him. They could have, and they didn't. Opportunity presented itself, and there was little support for it. It wasn't, of course, that slaves liked the situation that they were in. Indeed, when presented with an opportunity to run away during the Civil War, about 500,000 slaves freed themselves. And so there was no reason to think that Brown was anything more than a crazy nut who took the law into his own hands. Seward and Lincoln, prominent Republican politicians at the time, both spoke out against John Brown. So crazy guy, no support from slaves, no support from Northerners, leave it alone. After his capture, that seemed to be the way moderate and conservative politicians treated it. But during his trial and his hanging by the state of Virginia, the rhetoric heated up. The Northern press started to make Brown a martyr. Significant writers got involved. Henry David Thoreau said, "He's done more with his manly acts than any talking Republican politician." William Cullen Bryant said, "Brown was a hero and a martyr." And Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "He will turn the gallows into a cross." The crazy man has now become a hero, a cause celeb. These were big celebs. Thoreau, Bryant, and Emerson. That's like getting Springsteen, Clooney, and Bon Jovi to come out for your cause. I mean, I'm kidding, of course. These poets were more important than those guys. Well, Bryant was probably not as good a songwriter as Springsteen, but he was close. None of this delighted Southerners, and neither did the editorials they were seeing in the Northern press that was saluting what Brown did, even if Republican politicians were more moderate in tone. They realized that if this was the way the North reacted to an attack on their territory, there was no way they could deal with Northern aggression on this slavery issue. You have to keep in mind something. Newspapers were the way to tell public opinion, but not a great way. Newspapers could be controlled by a small group. If there were better polling, you probably would see more moderate stances on the issue of abolition in the North. Indeed, the Republican Party had trouble even in the late 1850s winning a gubernatorial election in Massachusetts, right? Supposedly the big Republican state, big abolitionist state. Couldn't even win the gubernatorial election there without getting the help of the Know-Nothing, the Nativist or American Party. But the newspapers and the editors supported abolition, and that's what the Southerners were seeing. In this environment, the late 1850s, going into the 1860 election, the extremists in both parties were winning. The South, Southerners, lost the House. The Democratic Party lost the House in 1858 to the new Republican Party. So they took over one branch of government already. All the Southerners and Democrats had left was the presidency. And in James Buchanan, Southerners had a supporter. But it was clear that since even the Southerners did not want to nominate Stephen Douglas, who they thought was a traitor to their cause, they were going to lose. Extremists such as Barnwell Rhett in Virginia, Chris Memminger in South Carolina, started agitating for secession. A disunionist, a secessionist, became governor of Mississippi. Jefferson Davis had long succeeded with a very strong stance, no interference with slavery. The Southerners wanted to repeal the ban on the slave trade. Congress had voted during Jefferson's presidency, as allowed to by the Constitution. Moderate Southern Democrats were plagued by extremists wanting to push the issue on slavery. Politicians in either party who tried to moderate got attacked. We talked about what Wendell Phillips said about Lincoln being a slave hound and a huckster. Stephen Douglas was called a turncoat and a weak Democrat. The Kansas-Nebraska Act, the Panic of 1857, and the economic needs, the bloody Kansas, John Brown. It was not a time for moderates in the party. This brought the extremes out. Where does Lincoln fit in? The common assertion now is that Lincoln was a moderate. He wanted conciliation with the South. But his politics are a little more extreme. While he wasn't an extremist abolitionist or an agitator in any sense, he took several positions in order to get advantage from the new political winds. First of all, his House divided speech, which reflects Lincoln's attitude, made it clear the nation could not be half slave or half free. He didn't want war. He wanted slavery to end in a different way, with compensation to the slaveholder or colonization, where the slaves would be sent to Liberia or another country in Africa, or gradual emancipation. So he could do it in a variety of ways, and this is why we now see Lincoln as the moderate politician. But he was extremist in this sense. He wanted a decision. House divided against itself cannot stand. To which, as we said, Stephen Douglas had asked, well, why not? You can just keep having votes and let people decide what they want to be, just like the way we've always done it in America. So Lincoln wanted a decision, and in that way he did force the issue. And his election made a statement. Secondly, he as a president, while he reached out to the better angels of our nature and to the mystic chords of memory in his inaugural speech, which was really aimed at the border states, Kentucky, Maryland, Missouri, as well as Virginia, which hadn't seceded yet when he took office. But he also pledged to defend federal property and take possession of forts or armories, many of which at the time of his inaugural speech were controlled by rebels and would have to be taken by force. I don't criticize him on this point, of course. It seems natural that a president, the leader of the federal government, would want to protect federal property. And in 1861, federal property had been seized by rebels. But Lincoln's assertion that he would defend federal property and take back forts, that was taken as a hostile statement by the South. Now, thirdly, Lincoln, as president-elect, rejected any compromise that would jeopardize what he felt Republicans won in the 1860 election. And on this, he was not the wishy-washy politician that we sometimes see him in revisionist history. He was firm on that. There was to be no slavery in the territories. That's what the election of 1860 was about. Republicans won the election. They had every right to take their policy and run the government that way. There would be no slavery in the new territories. Short of this, and here's where the moderate Lincoln does come in, Lincoln would allow anything in regards to slavery in the South where it existed at the time of his inauguration. Even a constitutional amendment, which ironically would have been the 13th amendment if it had passed. A constitutional amendment which would have allowed slavery where it existed and banned the federal government from doing anything about it until 1900. That had Lincoln's support, if at all, it could lead to compromise. It did not. And the fourth contribution that Lincoln made to the beginning of the Civil War was when he decided to reinforce Fort Sumner, which clearly forced the South to start the war. It was a clever move. You know, it certainly was not Lincoln's fault. This was a fort that was in the harbor of Charleston, and the Confederates had seized the harbor and had a significant amount of artillery around it. The question that the Buchanan administration never got around to answering was whether to reinforce the fort or not. Seward, Lincoln's Secretary of State, wanted not to reinforce the fort and to try to work something out with the rebels. Seward even began secret talks with various Confederates about the issue and said that Lincoln would agree with him and wouldn't reinforce Fort Sumner. Lincoln did reinforce the fort. He reinforced it without providing any additional arms. He merely reinforced the fort with food and needed supplies. The extremist politics were such, Confederacy at the time, that Jefferson Davis was pressured, and he in turn pressured the commanders in South Carolina to fire upon the fort, even though it was only being supplied with unarmed. So, you know, these are areas where, and again, not expressing disagreement with any of the positions that Lincoln took, which seemed to be right on the money, but Those were decisions that did indeed contribute to the fact that there was fighting rather than talking. Threes, three C's. Expansion, economics, extremists, constitution, culture, and finally, confidence. Why would confidence lead to war? Probably the main reason for the Civil War is that each side was confident it could push their hand. Right makes might, Lincoln would later say. Each one felt God was on their side. The North had the guns and the numbers, the industry, the bucks, the banks, connections to the settled Western states as far as Iowa, Indiana, Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin. It was just much bigger, the North. Better railroads, a literate population, larger cities with pools of potential draftees, Irish, German immigrant populations. The North had everything going for it, and it seemed like this calming of these rebels would be a small matter, and that was certainly reflected in the editorials of newspapers. Horace Greeley's New York Tribune, in the beginning of the conflict, had a huge headline that said, "Go to Richmond now, take it." It seemed so easy. On the other hand, the South was confident, and as it turns out, not so incorrectly so, about its military superiority. Southern military leaders had been part of the Mexican War. There were a good number of the men who went to West Point. They correctly assumed in the South that geography would be adequate for a defensive war, that their river system would help protect them, and that being that they would be on the defense, their position would be stronger. Psychologically, they'd be fighting for their own homeland. The Yankees would have to come in here and invade, and we'll be defending. It is not likely that they envisioned the type of serious invasion that ended up happening towards the end of the Civil War. Most likely, they thought that they could separate and perhaps not be forced to do anything at all, that they would be allowed to secede because nobody in the North wanted to start a war. And if they did, it would be a few minor skirmishes on the border. Yankees would retreat. It would all be over. They had seized federal armories during the Buchanan administration and got no pushback from that group. No armies were sent into the South. They wildly overestimated their connections with Britain and France. They had great confidence on this point of international relations because they had sold cotton to world capitals and dealt with them every day. They thought they would get their aid early on for this new Confederacy. And if they didn't, they could, as they tried to do, starve these world powers until they supported the Confederacy by refusing to sell them cotton. At the risk, perhaps the serious risk, of trivializing all this about the Civil War and the discussion of why did it start, why did fighting start rather than talking, consider that it's been 40 years since the Beatles went their separate ways. 40 years ago, 1970, Richard Nixon was president. Watergate was still just a hotel. The Fab Four called it quits. And what was the reason? Was it John Lennon? Was it Paul? Were they going in different creative directions? Was it that George Harrison wasn't getting enough songs per album? Was it that Yoko Ono was coming in on the recording sessions? Was it the drugs? Was it that the music wasn't good anymore? They were tired of it? Well, sure, all of these things were contributors. But you know, in the end, it was truly that each of these band members wanted to go out on their own. They thought they would do better in solo careers than they were doing with the Beatles. Better creatively, better financially. It didn't really work out. Paul McCartney did pretty good with Wings. Lennon had Imagine and Instant Karma. George Harrison had My Sweet Lord. These were catchy tunes, but it was never quite the dimension of music of the Beatles again. But they all thought they could do it. They all thought they'd be better off by splitting up. 40 years since the Beatles. What does this have to do with the Civil War anyway? Nothing at all except for this. In consideration of human behavior, We can list a bunch of reasons why something should have happened, a historical event, a bunch of possible causes for an event. But there's also a different dimension we have to look at, and that's the level of certainty. So let's bring it back to the Civil War. If, for instance, the South was angry over eight things, let's talk about this expansion of slavery into the territories, right? Let's talk about their mad about tariffs, perhaps. Let's talk about the economic conditions were pretty bad. Let's talk about the fact that they lost the Congress. Let's talk about the fact that they were about to lose a presidency that would support them. Let's talk about the fact that they were culturally very different from the North, yet joined by this Constitution together in the same country. Let's talk about all those things. None of them would start a war if those people didn't think they would win it. If they were afraid, all the causes in the world would not lead to sparking anything. But they weren't. The secessionists in the southern states thought rebellion would work. They thought they'd get away with it. Really wasn't rebellion in their eyes. It was just secession. Rebellion was the term used by Republican politicians and the northern press. These guys were rebels, and we needed to go down there and crush it. And the Union, too, thought they would succeed. I mean, the reason this is coming up is because of the discussion on health care, and it is a little heated out there. Opponents of the bill are certainly angry. Yet I don't think we were anywhere near 1861, of course, and the main factors that might cause people to fight rather than talk. One obvious consideration is that opposition or support for Democrats, Republicans, the health care bill, etc., is spread around the country. Sure, the southern states tend to be more Republican. But you don't have the same cultural differences between geographic regions that we once had. So the South and the North in the 1860s were very much like two countries. We don't have that anymore. There's disagreement, but it's all over the place. It's not concentrated in one area. Besides, free and fair, for the most part, elections will be held in November. And the American people can decide whether they want a new Congress or not. We were pretty far from being out of solutions. I want to thank you for listening. The website is myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. That's where you can get the archive. It's $9.99. We'll change at the end of April to $14.99. We adjusted the website a bit. The Facebook page is now the only place where you can comment. The reason for that is that it's just such a more dynamic website, and if you write something, there'll be other people that can comment on it, rather than the other website gets less traffic and there isn't a vibrant discussion there. I'm pretty good with topics. I have a number of podcasts in the queue, and I just have to get them written up, researched, and out. So I will start working on that. In the meantime, I want to thank you for listening.